Why stand still when you can run headfirst into a wall? You're listening to the Jocular Pugilists.
We're going to start the podcast today with a little music quiz. I'm going to play you a bunch of songs that all have something in common, starting with this song. I'm sure I got you thinking, because I'm sure you know those voices. How about this song? Because you're sweet and lovely, girl. I love you. Remember, they all have something in common. How about this song? If I needed someone to love, you're the one that I'd be thinking of. If I needed someone... If I'm being completely honest, I don't know that song. But how about this song? Have you heard this one? I don't wanna play away. Give me one more day, please. Hopefully your ears pricked up, because that was a different artist. This song, you've gotta know. Yeah, if you're older than 40, I'm sure you knew that song. This is even more popular. You remember this one? And then she asked me, do I look alright? And I say yes, you look wonderful. And last but not least, I know you know this one. So have you figured it out? It's probably one of the biggest love triangles of rock and roll history. All of those songs were written about one woman. That woman inspired incredible music. And today, we're going to look at not only her life a little bit, but also what I feel is the best of all of those tunes, Something. And we're going to tell you what we think is so special about that song.
So that's actually amazing. I didn't know. I knew that there was two songs, Something and Layla. I knew about that. I had no idea about the other songs, that they were all written about her. This makes me very interested in who she actually was, because clearly these two geniuses thought enough about her to write all this great music, you know?
Well, you would definitely think she'd have to be a pretty engaging, interesting person for that to happen. Besides that, I should also mention she had a love affair with a Rolling Stone.
Pretty incredible.
Yeah, imagine that. And they weren't just songs. There's many women that have had songs written for them by popular bands. But this number of songs, I don't think so. And the popularity of the songs, particularly the last three I played. That's pretty unfathomable.
Yeah. By the way, it is great to see you. So just to let everybody in on this, we were supposed to record yesterday. We had a little dust up and we ended up not recording. And I got to say, the rest of the day was just brutal. It's like I got into a fight with Stacy. It feels like that, you know?
We never fight on the air, but you can be assured that when the microphone is turned off, we're going at each other.
Yes, there is plenty of testosterone to go around the room.
Yeah. Hey, I don't know if I told you, but I saw Kevin Nealon this weekend, the comedian.
Ooh, really? Where'd you see him?
Saw him in Tarrytown. I think it's the first show, not I think, I know it's the first show that we've ever taken Gabriel to, meaning not show, but comedy show that we've ever taken Gabriel to. It was a lot of fun. He loved it. You know, for a kid of his age to not have his phone and just pay attention, he really enjoyed it. And I think it's like music. When you're in a group of people that are all laughing, it's infectious. You feel the energy so much better than being, you know, watching. Although Kevin Nealon's show, Hiking with Kevin, is a lot of fun, but seeing him live was so much better. So if you can, he's on tour now. I highly suggest seeing Kevin Nealon. It was a ton of fun. We also saw him walking in front of the theater, and I never say anything. But Tracy, Gabriel, and I were walking up. Tarrytown is on a hill. Their main street's on a hill. He's walking down the hill. We're walking up the hill. It's a real cute town. he was walking down the hill towards us, and I just looked at him and went, Kevin. It was more to say, that's Kevin Nealon. I mean, he knows who he is, but it was kind of stupid. But
did he do, I loved on SNL when he used to do Subliminal Man. Did he do any of that in the?
No. So I know his comedy a little bit now because I've been following him. And I really like, Tracy enjoys hiking with Kevin. So we get to share something, which is always good. Now, I mean, he did maybe one or two jokes that I've heard him do before, but it seemed like pretty much new material. And what I love about Kevin is the timing is so amazing. He's such a good, people might think his humor, some people might say, who knows, who am I, but his humor is silly humor. It's not sophisticated. I don't know. And we'll get into it with something because there's genius and beauty in simplicity.
Absolutely.
And sometimes it's way smarter than complicated humor. So, and there's a lot of payoffs. There's lines that he did throughout the set where it wasn't until later, he'll set something up, do a joke about it, then it'll come back again. Then it'll come back again. So it's great. No, he did a fantastic job.
That's
so
awesome.
What about you? What'd you do over the weekend?
Well, I've got a recommendation for you. Run, don't walk to go see The Fall Guy in theaters. It was so much fun. So okay. I don't know if you remember the Lee Majors TV show, The Fall Guy. He was a stuntman turned into, like, on his off time, he would be a bounty hunter. And so they did a movie about it with Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt. And it is hilarious, well-written, none of the nonsense that you're used to. It's just a great movie. Just a great movie. I was so happy.
Well, that's great. It's fantastic to hear that there's more movies being made that are just a good story, just a fantastic story. Not trying to teach anything, not trying to preach to you, just a good story. We need more of those, and there have been a bunch lately, so that's fantastic news.
That's it.
I think it's time to talk about the song, Phil.
Yeah.
So what we're going to do is talk about the song in a couple different ways. We'll talk about the social aspect of it, the lyrics, and we will talk about the music, which might get a little heady. Both Phil and I went to music school. If music theory is not your thing, it's very easy to skip ahead. We put chapters in all our podcasts now, so whether you're using Overcast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, there's a little chapter heading that you just touch and it goes exactly to the chapter you're interested in. If you at all are interested in a theory, I think it's great, so hopefully you'll learn something from it. Okay, so we're talking about the song Something, and by association, the Beatles. Now, as I was getting set up for the podcast, I thought about something. I just want to talk about our college experience just a little bit. Phil and I both, as I said, went to Berkeley. When we went to Berkeley, it was predominantly a jazz school, and the original guitar teachers that taught in the beginning of the guitar program, that didn't have a guitar program for the first 15 or 20 years, but somewhere around the early 60s, it had a guitar program. Those first teachers, which were strict jazz guitar players, that's the only thing they played and pretty much all they listened to, still taught at Berkeley. That was around 1990. They still were teaching there. So they were in their 70s or 80s at that point, getting ready to retire, but they were still there. And as such, they were very strict. Right now, it's a much more open school. Back then, not so much.
Yeah, and here's something we all did. Everybody who knew each other in the guitar department, we'd all find out who the real hard asses were and then try and avoid them, yes.
Yeah, of course. Yep. That's not unique to Berkeley. That's probably every school. What I was going to say about these teachers, they hated rock and roll. These were old, kind of stuffy jazz guys. But the one band, rock pop band, that they had a small modicum of appreciation for was the Beatles.
It's true, man. I even took, with an older guy, the music of John Lennon. It was actually a class taught at Berkeley, and I loved it. It was all analyzing John Lennon's music in the Beatles. It was incredible.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to say is, even back then, in the dawn of time, the Beatles were thought of as really good songwriters,
right,
as they still are thought of.
They better be. I'm going to take some issue with people who don't like the Beatles. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I should say that I did not grow up listening to the Beatles. Of course, if you grew up in the 70s and the 80s, you heard the Beatles on the radio all the time. So I heard them and was very familiar with their music, but I didn't listen to them. I listened to rock and roll, harder rock, meaning Led Zeppelin, The Who, Jimi Hendrix, AC/DC, things like that. Didn't listen to the Beatles. So it took a long time for my appreciation for the Beatles to grow. Phil, you were way hipper than me. You liked them right away. Not so much with me. But as I started teaching guitar, teaching people Beatles songs, as well as just playing their songs professionally, playing them out. I grew to really appreciate their music. And in fact, now I can listen to the Beatles without a thought. I still very much appreciate listening to the Beatles. A lot of the music I grew up with, let's say, I don't know, Whitesnake, I don't appreciate in the same way. Okay, let's get into the song. I'm going to start with a little factoid. Phil, do you know what two Beatles songs were covered more than any other Beatles songs by other artists?
I don't.
Well, number one's going to be obvious. Yesterday is the most covered song from the Beatles.
That makes sense.
But number two is an interesting one. It's Something, which I find interesting because it's a song that was written by George Harrison.
I had no idea. So a George Harrison song was more recorded than... That's incredible.
Exactly. So yeah, that's a big deal. And Phil, why don't you describe why that's a big deal?
Paul and John were the main guys, and they were writing from the very beginning of the Beatles. They were writing the music together. And George really wasn't a part of it, although I get the sense that maybe he always wanted to be. But as he got better as a writer, they started acknowledging him and saying, well, and he would sneak in one or two songs per record, more in the middle of their career, you know, and they were always interesting songs, very interesting musically, very interesting, although simple lyrically, and it was great. And he brought in a lot of that Middle Eastern sound.
Yeah. Great.
And, you know,
great. Yeah.
It's wild to me that that would be the second most covered songs. It surprises me.
It is strange. And people will say that Something represents the pinnacle of George Harrison's writing. It's the greatest song that he's ever written. They also will say it's one of the greatest Beatles songs ever recorded. And you know, I should mention, you can actually see when George first played his idea for Something to the Beatles, to John, Paul, and Ringo, in the documentary on Apple. I forget what it's called.
Get Back. Get Back.
Get it's, Back. Oh, okay.
It is 6 hours.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's why. It's difficult to watch the whole thing. I only watched 2-4, which is a lot. and I probably wasn't paying attention to the whole thing. But as a musician, it's great to see how they wrote. Because they're not technically these... That's one of the things we should mention. They're not technically the best players. There are better players than them that were existing well before they were ever playing their instruments. But they were just... It seemed at that moment in time, music flowed through them.
And it was really fascinating, since you brought that up, to look at when the keyboard player, who I can't think of his name right now, but he's a famous organ player, when he jumped in on some of the music, it even elevated it more. Like, here are these rock legends, and it struck me that
Billy Preston,
thank you.
Yeah, I just looked it up, so I'm not a genius. Go ahead.
I was expecting to see some unique way of writing or something that was beyond a normal human being's capability, because these are the Beatles. But it really was fun to watch that, you know, they weren't always sure about what was gonna work, and some of their riffs weren't what they turned into. You know what I mean? They all had a starting point,
yeah.
And that was a real great lesson to learn, because sometimes when you're writing music, you're just like, you just want to throw stuff away because it's not that brilliant thing. You know what I mean?
Yep, absolutely. And it's funny, too, because when I get into the theory of it, I have more theory knowledge, I'm sure, than they do, but they write better music than me. So it's just whether it flows through you, it doesn't, being knowledgeable or being really good at your instrument doesn't mean you're going to be able to write good music or play good music. It's like that with everybody, with everything.
100%. You can totally overthink when you're writing.
Yeah.
And overprocess and over-intellectualize, and it will stop you or, you know, stifle your creativity.
Yeah, I mean, it's about, obviously, about utilizing the skills you have and not having any barriers. But beyond that, it's also about being in the right place, in the right time, with the right people. And the Beatles had that. And luckily for us, all of those things converged when the Beatles released the album that Something is on, Abbey Road. Something is the second track in what is arguably the finest rock and roll album to ever be released. Whether it is or not, I don't know, but it is certainly a masterpiece. It was also the final studio album to be recorded by the Beatles, although it was released before Let It Be. Let It Be was recorded before Abbey Road, if that makes sense. It was released in September of 1969. Now, I'd like to talk a second about George Harrison as a songwriter. Now, he wrote 22 songs for the Beatles, which seems like a lot of songs, right? But if you compare it to how many songs John and Paul wrote, 694, it's a small amount. So you might think there was a lot of competition to get a good song on a Beatles album. And I think there was. I think, though, if you look at the documentary film, they were pretty positive about something. In fact, John said it was his favorite song on Abbey Road. But if you look at the documentary, there's a whole section of it that George just walks out and says, I'm done with you guys. I can't take this anymore.
He feels like he's being told what to do, particularly with the guitar parts. And that's an interesting thing to feel because you have ownership over your instrument, right? And so you do, the last thing you want is your bass player telling you what you should be playing as the guitar player for the Beatles. You know, of course, your ego is going to kick up a little bit and be like, all right, I'll play whatever you want me to play. If you have something better, sure, I'll play it. But all the while thinking, hey, have some respect for me on my instrument because this is what I do.
Which I guess bears out that saying, nothing good comes easy. So it wasn't easy for them, but my God, did they leave us with amazing music.
Yep.
And when we decided to do this podcast, I thought it would be fun to watch the music video that accompanies the song Something. That might be a head scratcher. Wait, there was music videos in 1969? I thought MTV started in the 1980s. Yeah, well, back then they did music videos, but they were used as promotion. Often weren't even played on TV. They would just give them as a promotional material. So there was a video that accompanied Something. Now, here's the interesting thing. It was filmed after John Lennon announced that he was leaving the Beatles. So as such, there's a lot of conjecture that musicologists and music writers have about the video and what was going on. An interesting fact is each member of the Beatles is filmed in this video separately, not together. They weren't in the same place with their significant others. Because it said that they couldn't stand to be in the same room together at that point.
Right.
And in fact, I read that if you look, and it's on Wikipedia, if you look at, which I get all my information from, if you look at the Beatles in the film, you'll see that Paul is disheveled, George is very solemn, as well as John, very solemn. They're all wearing their pain on their faces. I did not get that impression. What I saw was four different couples that were very happy to be with each other. A lot of smiles. Mm-hmm. Ringo's with his then-wife, Maureen. He eventually married Barbara Bach, who is a Bond girl, actually, and he's still married to her. But back then, he was married to Maureen, it was her name. I can't remember the last name, but of course, Maureen Starr, I guess. And they're on mini bikes, being very playful. John and Yoko have capes on. They look like they're teachers at Hogwarts.
I wonder if that's where she got that from.
Yeah.
J.K. Rowling, let's see. If you want to call in, please.
Paul, of course, he's a little bit, you know, like he just woke up. He's not made up or anything. But Linda's being really playful with him, and they seem like they're having a great time. And here comes the important one, because it's the person the song is written about. George seems to be having a great time with his spouse. The person that this song and actually many other songs were written about. And in fact, we haven't even told you her name yet. Phil, why don't you tell us a little bit about Patty Boyd?
So Patty Boyd was a model back in the 60s. She and George met on the film A Hard Day's Night, which if you haven't seen it, and you're at all a Beatles fan, go check it out. I mean, it's a great movie. She also, early on in her career, wrote a column titled Patty's Letters from London. And this was in the American Team magazine 16.
Huh.
She and George started dating. They were a couple just fun facts about them and their relationship. They were arrested on March 12th, 1969, which was actually the day that Paul and Linda got married, for possession of cannabis at their home, which is, you have to imagine, the British police kind of storming George Harrison, a Beatles home, to catch them with cannabis. That's a very different time.
I'm sure that was in no small part due to him being a Beatle and doing the drugs.
I think you're right. So they were married then in July of 1974. She said that she was leaving George. And her reasons for leaving him was based largely on his repeated infidelities, culminating in, and I did not know this, an affair with Ringo Starr's wife, Maureen, which is probably why they're not married anymore.
Oh, wow.
Being a British rock star back in the 60s. Now, it also was the time of free love and all of that, yeah. You know, but certainly when you're a rock star, I suppose, you know, everybody shares. I don't know. During the time that they were married, Eric Clapton got to know Patty Boyd because he was friends with George Harrison, fell in love with her, ended up dating her sister just to stay close. And finally, in 1970, during the writing of the album Derek and the Dominoes, he wrote Layla. And that was his proclamation of love for Patty Boyd. Now, she was still married to George Harrison and did not want to get involved and
was she?
Turned him down.
I thought they were already broken up at that point, so I didn't know that. Okay.
They were together. At least this is what I found. Now, she said no to him, but then when they were getting a divorce, so she said she was leaving him in 74, Clapton swooped back in, and that's when they started dating. Now, If you have other information, I would love to hear it because this is what I found.
No. I'm going by what I remember.
Oh, okay.
But I remember reading that she had somewhere in the pre-Rolling Stones Faces time of Ron Wood's career, she had an affair with Ron Wood as well.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
All right.
So she might have been married at the time.
I tend to believe this part of the story only because I remember thinking, well, George Harrison and Eric Clapton stayed friends. They didn't, you know, blow up. You and I would be mortal enemies if something like this happened.
Especially if it's your wife.
Yes, of course. Harrison called Clapton his husband-in-law. You know, that's how they joked around about it. So my guess is he really understood that the breakup was on him, although I'm sure he loved his wife, but he couldn't blame Eric Clapton for what happened, you know? So interesting, really interesting. I'm glad I looked that up because that actually explained some things that I was always curious about.
And eventually Clapton and Patty broke up as well.
For the same reasons. Infidelity on Eric Clapton's part.
And he also was a drug addict, so I'm sure he wasn't pleasant to live with. I should mention this. When we think of rock and roll and relationships, it's sex, drugs, and rock and roll, right? So there's all these stories of, in fact, there's a woman that wrote a book about all of her one-night stands with famous rock and roll musicians. I don't get the impression that's what it was like with Patty Boyd. I could be, of course, completely wrong because I don't know her, but I get the impression that she had a limited amount of relationships. Now, of course, some of them were infidelities, but if you recognize that she was dealing with lots of infidelity as well, I think it's a lot more understandable.
Of course, yes. I agree.
You know?
I really get the sense that she was just looking for love and the people in her circle were all rock stars. Okay, so that's who she's dating.
So if you'll indulge me, Phil, I'd love to play some cover versions of something.
Okay.
Because as I said before, it is the second most covered Beatles song in their whole catalog. So there are some wonderful covers of it. And when I say the word wonderful, I mean it in both, well, they actually are pretty good. And what the heck is that way? So let's listen to it now. Starting with the chairman of the board, Frank Sinatra. Yes. Frank Sinatra did a cover of something, and it's one of my favorites.
Something in the way she moves attracts me like no other lover. Something in the way that
that she woos me.
That can't be your favorite.
No. It's just for the silliness of it. Something, Jack. You know? Which, by the way, he does in the recording.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, he said it was one of the greatest love songs ever written. Something. A lot of these covers are going to surprise you. Like the next one, Elvis Presley covered Something, and he did it in his Honolulu special.
Something in the way she moves.
Which I love, because this is just pre-Las Vegas Elvis. So he had the schmaltz thing. So when they would clap, often he would go, thank you very much, thank you. So he would sing a line to you, thank you very much, thank you. The next one I'd like to call to your attention is Shirley Bassey. She sang Goldfinger. So think of Goldfinger. Goldfinger! It is enormous. It is huge. So she does a BAM version of
wow.
Something. An enormous, huge orchestration, enormous voice. If you think of George's version of it, it's very subdued and sweet and gentle. Not so much with Shirley.
You're asking me for my love. Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
You got me thinking, where's the Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin version of this song?
Well, there are. There's a Ray Charles version of it. It's awesome. There's a clarinet and a pedal steel. It's very orchestrated.
How cool is that?
There's a string section. There's some background singers that do a ba-ba-ba into the B section.
You're asking.
There's him. He sounds good. Apparently, George liked it. There's a Joe Cocker version of it. It was originally written for Joe Cocker. He didn't do it, but luckily the Beatles did it, which I like. There's an organ wah solo in the George Cocker version, so you got to be into organ instead of guitar. And one of my favorites, just absolute favorites, and it was one of George's favorites too. He actually had it on his jukebox. Was James Brown. I got to have something.
I got to believe in something.
Wanna believe. Got to believe. Something in the way she moves attracts me like no other lover.
It's awesome.
That is awesome. Wow. Yeah. And I'm sure he brought his spin to it.
Oh my God. It's so silly. I mean, it's beyond silly, but awesome in the same time. It's silly, but amazing. I really think it's an amazing version. All right. So I bring it all up because how do those compare to the original? And they're all great. But they don't shine a candle for me to the original. And why is it? You know, because they're all great artists. I mean, it have something to do with, well, George wrote it, so he can emote more in it. It could possibly be that. But I'm going to go back to what I said earlier. A great pop song is not only about the singer, the song, and the musicians. It's also about capturing a perfect moment in time. Meaning it's when it was recorded, how it was recorded, and where it was recorded. Mm-hmm. Think about all the bands that have tried to redo some of their older materials to get cleaner, better recordings of it. It almost never works out because it's almost impossible, I would dare say impossible, to capture the magic of a perfect recording, that magical moment in time.
And I have to say, you know, a lot of bands, don't even record in the same room anymore. And you miss something. Like back in the day, they didn't even have the technology to record overdubs or to do a lot of overdubbing. They could do some, but not a ton. So what you'd have is the band in the room together recording the basic tracks, and then maybe you'd record the vocals and maybe a guitar solo or whatever. But that was it. And when you don't do that, when you don't have the band playing, connecting together, you end up with something a little more artificial and a little more stale. And it's the reason why bands like Pearl Jam, on their new record, they recorded it all together. They made the decision because they know it's going to sound more organic. We're going to capture something more special if we're all together in the same room recording.
Yeah, and of course, there's the debate with technology and modern music. I'm sure people are aware of this. Whenever you hear a modern song, and when I'm saying modern, I don't mean young artists. I mean any artist. It's been edited, and usually heavily edited. Now, of course, things were edited before. When the Beatles recorded something, if they did a poor take, they would do it again. But it was them playing. It was them singing. Now, you sing it once. You don't have to be in the studio. They'll fix it after the fact, digitally.
Yeah.
Does that take something away from the spontaneity, the magic of the moment? That's debatable, but in my estimation, yes, it definitely does. So let's talk about the lyrics, Phil.
To your earlier point, these are not super complicated lyrics, but they're brilliant. So I wanted to break them down. And the first thing Tomas and I were talking about sort of off mic was that, you know, he doesn't even really say the word love. He doesn't even, it's a love song without the word love. Now, love is in lyric, but the way he uses it is not the way you'd think it would be. And it made me think of, you know, I'm a big Billy Joel fan. It made me think of that song, She's Got Away, which is also a brilliant love song, says nothing about love. It just talks about the person in a very loving way. And that's like this does. Mm. So let me go through the lyrics. So it starts out, something in the way she moves me attracts me like no other lover. Something in the way she woos me. It feels like a traditional love song at this point.
Yeah.
Right? He's talking about, he's in love with this woman. Amazing. Then the next lines, I don't want to leave her now. You know I believe in how. All of a sudden, it sounds like it might be a breakup song. Well, wait a minute. All right. Is this somebody breaking up? And then it goes back into the verse, back into the traditional love. Something in her smile, she knows that I don't need no other lover. Something in her style that shows me. Simple lines, but wow, it paints this picture of this guy who's just in awe of this woman, right? And it's back to a traditional love song, and then it comes in, I don't want to leave her now, you know I believe in how.
Yeah, a refrain.
Right, a refrain, perfect. Now, when you go into the chorus, it's again another song. You're asking me, will my love grow? I don't know, I don't know. It's actually, they're not broken up, it's a relationship in flux. It's what I imagine here is, she's asking the question. She's asking George Harrison, you know, I feel like you're not in love with me the way I'm in love with you. And he's saying back to her, you know, it may grow. I don't know. I don't know what's going on. But, and then it says, you stick around, now it may show, but I don't know. I don't know. And so he's literally saying to her, maybe it'll get better, but I can't give you a guarantee. So it's like three different songs in these short groupings.
Right.
And it's so fascinating to me the way he was able to do that with these simple, simple lines. And then it goes back into the, you know, the traditional verse, something in the way she knows, and all I have to do is think of her, something in the things she shows me. And I don't want to leave her now. You know, I believe in how. I mean, it's, again, so simple, but wow. And it was a real lesson for me about the economy of words, because I love lyrics. Yeah. I love lyrics. When I write lyrics, they tend to be more involved and complicated. And like, you know, I really labor over each line, and I may have all in the same song, a chorus, a pre-chorus, you know, three long verses and a bridge. Mm. You don't need mm-hmm. all that. What I'm realizing is, again, like you said, this is one of the greatest songs ever written, or most beautiful songs, in our opinion, ever written. And it's simple lyrically, and yet it does so much.
As you're describing the lyrics, what comes to mind is there's really no way to describe love. If you've ever tried to write a love letter, you know words fail you. And when you're young, it can be overwhelming when you first feel those emotions. Even when you're older, it can be overwhelming if you allow the emotions to flow. No poem, no song can ever perfectly describe that feeling. So I feel like this song does a good job of saying that. What is it? It's something. I don't know how to describe it. It's powerful, and it's something about you. And I love that.
That is beautiful. That is exactly right. Something, just that word, mm-hmm. tells you that he's not even sure why he feels the way he does, but he does.
And I think it's pretty great that when you look at the title, Something, I don't think you'd have any clue that that was a love song until you listened to it.
By the way, the other thing that it made me think of, do you know that, you know that saying, don't bore us, get to the chorus?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like the early Beatles tunes, they even started with the chorus.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think they did that on purpose because this is the catchiest part. People don't know who we are. Let's put it right up front so that they hear the catchy part, the part you're going to sing and walk away with. Mm-hmm. Let's get right to the good stuff.
Genius.
And then we'll make them wait till it happens again. That's a great way of going about it. I think it's time now for us as musicians to talk about why we think this song is so fantastic.
Yeah, and listen, we get that we're both musicians, and when we go into some of the details about how a song is structured, that it might be, you know, too much, or you might not be interested, and that's totally fine. There's going to be a time code where you can jump forward if you want to. I find this stuff really, really interesting, especially when somebody like Tomas breaks a song musically down for me. So now if he goes too technical, I will try and do my best to break it down for anybody who's listening so that you can understand. But for me, this is what I've been waiting for this whole episode to hear.
Well, man, I hope I don't let you down. What do I hear when I listen to Something? Well, like anybody, the first thing that strikes you is the vocal melody. And it's a beautiful, simple, descending vocal melody. Love it. Then the next thing that struck me actually was the bass. Paul McCartney is playing some really beautiful, fun, contrapuntal melodies, which means that they are different rhythmic and melodic ideas than the vocal melody that play beautifully together. But as I listened to it more and more, I started hearing melodies within the chords, which is interesting. So if you think of music as being melody, that is the single notes, and harmony, multiple notes, take a guitar, take a pick, your hand, and strum a chord. There's more than one note ringing at a time. How can there be melodies within the chord? Well, the movement of one chord to another always creates melodies, because within one chord, there are lots of notes. And within most pop music, there's not a lot of thought to the harmonic melodies that are going on. In this song, I believe George thought deeply about it and picked chords with particular melodies. So now let's count. There's the vocal melody. That's one melody. There's the bass that's playing melodies. That's two melodies. There's John who's playing a melody. And there's George who's playing a melody. That's four melodies. It's starting to become Bach. There's a lot of stuff going on here that's deceptive. You wouldn't even notice it.
Yes.
And I'm not even done. Because there's organ, I believe Billy Preston is playing on it, doing pads, but then he plays a rhythmic thing. There's also a string arrangement by George Martin playing other melodies. That's too many for me to count. It would seem to be too much for a song. Just there's too much going on. It's going to be chaotic. How is that music? It works together unbelievably well. And I think one of the keys is the structure of the song is much like a pop song today. It's really simple. There's only two sections to the song. There's the verse refrain, and there's the B, the bridge section, and it goes right back to the verse refrain. So it goes A, B, A. Crazy simple structure, with a really interesting build within it, with all of these melodies wrapped up to make it interesting.
Yeah, again, not only lyrically, but in the music, it's beautiful because it's simple. And because even in that simpleness of the sections, what Tom's going to describe when he was talking about the counterpunctal lines, counterpunctal basically just means, you know, working sort of against each other, but in creating a harmony. It's incredible what he accomplishes in this short, very simply structured song.
Let's start with the vocal melody. The vocal melody is this gorgeous descending line. So George is singing the melody and playing the guitar. And while George is singing this, Paul is playing a different melody. He's playing something like this. Now I'm playing it on guitar, so you have to imagine it in the register of a bass, an octave lower. But as you can see, it's kind of active, isn't it? It's moving around a lot, but it works beautifully with the melody.
Yeah, it elevates the melody. It definitely does. It's a separate melody.
Now, what about George? What is George playing on the guitar? He's singing a melody, but he's playing something different on the guitar. And I think this is probably the spark of the song. The first thing he does is he plays this chromatic, beautiful melody. And that probably sparked the idea of the song. Now, that I said the word chromatic. It doesn't matter if you know what that means. It basically means that at one point it goes out of key. If you think of a chord progression, most of the time pop music is in a key, and maybe it'll change key, but within a chord progression, it usually stays in key. This does not. This moves out of a key immediately and right back to a key. So the chord that's the culprit is this chord. That's not a usual chord, but he needed to pick a chord with that particular note, and that's what he picked. So if we get really geeky just for a second, you're in the key of C major, and he plays from an F, which is the four chord of C major. If you know what that means, it's kind of cool. If you don't worry about it. He goes out of key, plays an E flat. They ain't in key. So what's going on?
Which almost changes the song to a minor. Well, if it was in the key of C, it would be a minor key for a second.
Exactly. He's switching to the parallel minor key, and he's not even playing a root chord. He's not playing C minor. He's playing E flat, which is related to C minor. Very sophisticated. Doesn't matter if you understand it. What he's doing, amazing, which is genius, is he's creating tension because he eventually resolves to C, and it feels wonderful when he starts singing.
And let's put this in perspective. The 60s was so interesting because that's when in rock music or in popular music, they started doing things like this. Before that, in the early rock days, it was all the one, everything in key, 1-4-5, exactly what Tomas was explaining. Like all the Chuck Berry, the Elvis Presley, all of that stuff is all in key, straight ahead. You know, this kind of singer-songwriter-y stuff is more interesting, and it's when at least popular music started getting really interesting harmonically. Yeah,
and it has to be said that the Beatles, they weren't just sticking to one thing. They weren't in a strange exotic scale or in a certain key and then moving to another key. Within the progression, it's rocking back and forth consistently from things that are very rooted, grounded, and feel like simple music that you would know. And then immediately putting you in a place that's a little bit more uncomfortable so that the payoff to that wonderful place is even sweeter. Now, when someone writes a song, generally, they're either starting with the melody or the chords, the harmony. They pick up a guitar, start strumming a bunch of chords, they sound good together, and they make up a melody and write some words to it. What do you think George started with this song?
Oh, that is the age-old question, isn't it? You know, it depends. If you're really an instrumentalist, like a guitar player, a rock guitar player, a lot of it starts with the riff and the guitar part and whatever. You know, it depends on what instrument you're writing on. What I've noticed is piano players tend to start with the melody.
Yeah. Like I said, I bet you the lick started the whole process. He did that.
Right.
And then maybe he could have rocked back and forth, played a chord, sang a melody, or sang a melody and figured out a chord for it. Who knows? I get the feeling the melody was more important than the song, but who knows? You'd have to go back in time and be there to see how it happened.
Yep.
All right, so we talked about the beginning guitar melody. We talked about the vocal melody. We talked about what the bass is doing. What about the guitar? What the guitar is playing while George is singing? And he's doing something beautiful as well. Did you hear that? There's a beautiful descending melody wrapped up in that chord progression. But he doesn't stop there. After that, he plays this. Then a little lick. Then there's this beautiful melody. Can you hear it? It's on the bottom of the chord. So in those chords, you have this melody. And actually, while George is doing that, John is playing this. So what's going on? He could have just played simple chords, strummed the chords a la, I don't know, Taylor Swift, and not had all these melodies within the chords. Could have sat in one chord for much longer, but he didn't. He did things called chord cliches. That's a jazz term. It doesn't matter. He played something that was contrapuntal to what was going on. Because, in my estimation, it made it great.
Yeah. And here's the perfect place for me to mention, you know, to illustrate something like this. You've probably been out and seen a jazz guitar player on his own. He's at a cocktail hour and you see him doing these kind of elaborate version of Christmas tunes or whatever the jazz tunes. And you hear him playing the melody while he's playing the chords. That's called a chord melody. And what Tomas is talking about is similar to that. It's that idea where there's this melody that's going on while he's playing the chords to the song. So he doesn't have to sing if he wants for you to hear that melody.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to also say that there's consistently moments that he pulls the rug out from under your feet. You think you know where it's going to go, and he tricks you, but he eventually gets there. Again, I feel like it makes it even sweeter when he finally gets to where you expect it to go.
I have a question for you here, Tomas, because it's something that I've never been able to fully articulate, but I understand it when I hear it. There are musicians and bands, like progressive rock, for example, that will do complicated things and they sound complicated and it kind of can take you out of enjoying listening to it. And then there are bands or songs like this that have a lot of complicated stuff in them, but they sound beautiful and simple. So how do you explain that, really?
Yeah, and that's something that I grew to love about the Beatles. It's difficult to explain, but it's what I love about them. When I was younger, I gravitated towards complicated stuff. I like King Crimson and crazy stuff. They're amazing musicians, and they write great tunes. But the Beatles, for me, took a little bit longer to appreciate. I had a fantastic musician once say to me, writing a really complicated song, it's not hard to do. It's just time-consuming. Writing a simple, beautiful song, now that's hard to do.
Yes. Yes. Wow, that's great.
All right, let's just listen for a second to what I just described and see if you can hear all of the melodies in the B section. You'll notice that the bass is in one ear and the guitar should be on another side in another ear. Attracts me like no other lover. It's that other something little melody there. Here comes the guitar lick. Now here's this chromatic descending melody. You hear John? All right, after that, the song modulates. It goes to the B section and it changes keys in a very surprising way. You're asking me, will my love, you hear the strings now? It's getting very dense. Beautiful descending line. They start the phrase again. You stick around, now it may show. When they end it in a different place. And then George plays a gorgeous guitar solo. Man, I have so much to say. I've just scratched the surface as I'm listening to it. I have more and more things that are coming up. I'm trying to make it simple, but it's difficult to make it simple because there's a lot going on. If anyone is interested and would like to hear more, I do private lessons. We could talk about music. And the Jocular Pugilists are willing to do a Patreon where we discuss music. If that's interesting, you just let us know. We'd love to.
So for all of you who have listened to us geek out, thank you for sticking around with us. But this is how deep this stuff can go. Like when you really start breaking this stuff down, it's not... Some of it's an accent. Like, it's amazing that these were written by people who never went to school for it because they did what their ears heard. When you analyze it, boy, there's a lot of complexity there. And how cool is that?
All right, so as Phil said, we geeked out. Hopefully you enjoyed that. So why is this music so fantastic to us? Besides all of the geeky stuff, what makes it beautiful? And I'm going to just mention something. Hopefully I didn't mention this in the podcast before, but it hit me like a ton of bricks in this song. Years ago, I watched a PBS documentary on Beethoven, and there was all these different musicologists that talked about how important and significant Beethoven was to music, and to classical music, but to music. One of them had this sarcastic way of speaking, and he was very funny. He was a German theorist and musicologist, and he said something that hit me like a ton of bricks, and I think it's very true with the Beatles and with this song. He said, "We use the term genius far too much. In reality, there was only a couple musical geniuses that ever existed, and Beethoven is one. And I believe the Beatles are also one of those geniuses." He explained it like this. He said, "What Beethoven did that was so unbelievably important was he introduced these musical revolutions, but he did so with velvet gloves. He did it in a way that anyone that listens to it can appreciate and love." And that's what the Beatles do. They introduce these beautiful musical revolutions in the most gorgeous, simple way. That is true genius. And to me, you don't get more musical genius than the Beatles.
I think you said it perfectly. That is absolutely how I feel about it. So, we are the Jocular Pugilists. Thank you for sticking around for this one. We know it's a little bit longer, but we got to have a little fun, a little musical fun. Sometimes we don't get enough music together, so this was a special one, certainly for me. You can learn more about us at thejocularpugilist.com. You can also support the podcast by going to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, leave a 5-star rating and review and a follow. And Tomas, if they want to reach out to us and give us some suggestions or just...
just berate us. Berate us. Well, they can do so at thejocularpugilists@gmail.com.
Excellent. Man, I hate to love you.
There's something about you, Phil. I can't put my my finger on it. I don't know. I just don't know.